Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Project Zion podcast. This is Brittany Mangelson, and I will be your host today. And we are going to be talking about the sacraments with my good friend, David Lloyd. So, David, welcome to the podcast. I don't think we've had you on Project Zion before, have we?
No, I've decked and covered many times, so.
But I roped you in for this one, and I laughed.
Yeah, I'm stuck with you. All right.
So, David, why don't you just introduce yourself a little bit to our listeners? Just tell us a little bit about yourself. Did you grow up in the church? Just anything that you think would be of interest to the people listening.
Yeah, well, I'm a multi-generational member of Community of Christ, and have actually made a career since, well, before college in working for the church. And I pride myself in working in probably the most diverse, different jobs from each other through my sword career in working as a full-time minister. Everything from a youth minister to a full-time pastor to a regional content expert, mission center president, and headquarters staff, and yada, yada, yada. And I keep clicking along, doing things with the church. I've worked outside of the church and found a lot more satisfaction working for the church. It's part of my passion. And I've seen it go through a lot of changes over the years, and it's been fun to be on this journey.
So it sounds like you have a wide range of experience, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to get you on to talk about this topic, the sacraments. So I guess before we dive in, we need to kind of lay some groundwork. What do we mean when we say sacraments? Yeah. I'm curious on how they're viewed in Community of Christ, just that kind of thing.
Yeah, so I'll tell you how I got engaged with the sacraments of the church. You know, after having the practice of being a part of the sacraments all my life, when it came time to help write the elders course for the most recent version of the training course that we have for every person who's called to the office of elder, we found that we wrote the resource and did as we normally do in Community of Christ. We did a great job in talking about the theology and the ethereal part of what sacraments were. And we went out and field tested it and found out that people were saying, you know, we appreciate that, but what we really need to know is what's the right way of doing the sacraments, the right, in quotes, way of doing the sacraments. And so that caused a lot of difficulty, because in a church that goes over so many cultural differences, we found that as far as the practices of the sacraments, we had quite an array of different traditions. And so the First Presidency wanted a more streamlined way of saying to our priesthood, this is what you are required to do, that it's either in the Doctrine and Covenants or by World Church Action. These are things you are required to do, but there are also all these traditions, and we don't want to throw away tradition, but it doesn't mean we need to be bound by them. So we want to list traditions. And then we also wanted to give helpful tips that that might help people actually do the performance. Well, in the midst of all this, we found that sometimes our actions in the rituals didn't match our theology or methodology of why we do some of these sacraments. So it caused us a lot of deep thinking in regard to, you know, what a sacrament is. So we have 8 sacraments in Community of Christ, and we can go over each one of those and discuss, you know, how they're put together. But the First Presidency at World Conferences last year kind of gave a little bit more of an indicator of how we mark what a sacrament is, and they use 3 words: sign, word, and covenant in determining, you know, what the markers or indicators of the sacraments are, and that there are some universals of sacraments of wholeness and peace, of interrelatedness, of grace and reconciling activity, and self-revelation of Jesus Christ. So in particular, sacraments are certain procedures or rituals that use words and practices that are universals and more understandable or relevant and applicable. So such as required particulars in baptism is water and the symbolism of that, and in the Lord's Supper, the grape juice and the bread, and how these ancient rituals and some more recent rituals have become markers in the church of sacramental ministry. So that's a basic overview of what a sacrament is.
Yeah, I like that you pointed out that they're ancient. And when you say church, I'm assuming you mean the larger Christian church,
yes,
not just our
yes.
local denomination. Yeah, so there's something that ties us to a more ecumenical body of Christ, which I think is pretty significant.
Yeah, and then we also have some unique portions, such as laying on of hands for the sick and evangelist blessing that are not necessarily a part of other Christian denominations. And interesting enough, in other Christian denominations, some kind of ritual at the end of life has been a part of the greater Christian church. And yet in Community of Christ, we don't have something that is called sacramental that has to do with end of life. So it's interesting the interplay that happens.
Yeah, it is interesting. And I know that even with communion or the sacrament of the Lord's Supper between denominations, that is played out and looks very different, which I always find fascinating to kind of...
Yes. Yeah, and I think since it is one of the most common sacraments, and let's start with that, the Lord's Supper is something we share with the greater Christian community, and something that has a quite a restoration heritage to it. I mean, we still use the communion prayers that Joseph Smith used, although we have updated the language in English recently and also created a combined prayer for both the bread and the grape juice and other interesting parts of it. But when we get back to why do we do this, a lot of it focuses on community. Each one of the sacraments has something deeply revelatory to the individual, but also equally revelatory to the community. And those two components bring it together. And so in baptism, we've got this strange ritual when you really pull it apart. You know, we're inside of a building in many cases in the United States and getting together in a hot tub to dunk somebody. And the consideration of that ritual as being an acceptance of discipleship definitely has to be unraveled so that people who are new to that experience understand what the purpose and meaning of it is. And so with baptism, we have this initial experience that symbolizes death and resurrection and symbolizes new life. And we have this way that we lower somebody into the font and bring them back up. And it's a wonderful experience, but there always were the people who, when somebody's toe came out of the water during the baptism, you know, would require them to redo the baptism because they weren't fully immersed. And so somehow there was something mystical about the full immersion. And if it wasn't full immersion, it wasn't a real baptism and God didn't count it. And moving into the time of understanding that we are not doing the abracadabra of sacraments. We are meeting people where they are on the journey and putting up a mile marker. Each one of the sacraments is a mile marker. It's something that's happening in the here and now, but just importantly is the acknowledgement of what's happened before that's led to that point and what will happen from that point on. So it really is an experience in both time and space that baptism is that point in time where an individual says, I want to be a disciple. I count myself as one of Jesus's followers. And of course, they were making that decision before they ever got in the baptismal font. And hopefully they'll be able to carry that through into their future as a disciple. So we've made such a big point in the past of the moment of the sacrament without recognizing the more eternal experience that's taking place within each one of those sacraments.
So do you think that part of this idea of getting stuck on the mechanics of the sacraments had to do with the idea that we were the one true church and we had the only correct priesthood authority and it had to be through us and or God?
Yeah, it really did surround priesthood authority. I think that would be the focal point. So in the past, we believed that the sacraments were performed by one with authority. And then when you pull apart that too, I mean, what does it mean, authority? In most cases, we talked about people who spoke with authority, which basically meant they spoke rather dogmatically and could put sentences together well and preached good behind the pulpit. And that doesn't necessarily mean that that person knows what they're talking about. So authority, in quotes, is when you look at it from our past and in the RLDS church and growing up, the authority has morphed into the communal and personal experience. So the authority of priesthood, let's talk about that for a minute. The authority of priesthood, we used to believe that God called men and those people had the hands laid on them, and immediately after the hands came off, they were equipped. They went without purse or script and did their job because they were ordained with authority. And then we started to recognize varying degrees of ability and education and desire in priesthood and talked about authority. What does make authority? Well, we came up with four areas in Community of Christ where priesthood authority is found. First of all, the call from God. Is God calling someone? And second, right next to it, is does someone recognize it and accept it? And the third would be the authority of the granting institution, the church, the Community of Christ, recognizing someone as a priesthood member. And finally, and very importantly, the people to whom they minister, do they accept that person as a minister? Without one of those four areas, there is no authority, if we can still use that word, found in priesthood today. Because if you're not accepting the call, well, then where's your authority? If the institution doesn't recognize it, well, how can you practice it? And if the local people don't accept your ministry, then where is your ability to minister? So it relies more on the ability and acceptance of a person ministering than it does in regard to that word authority in the past. So that begins to affect then how the sacraments are experienced and recognized as being, for lack of a word, kosher, you know, right in the church. Because if you've got a priesthood member who has not been a ministry giver to the congregation, it makes it more difficult to accept that sacrament. And we pick people to ordain us or to bless our children or, you know, we pick ministers who we feel have brought us great examples of ministry. And so there is the authority of the past replaced by the ministerial effectiveness of the present. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It sounds like a lot of relationship is at the core of this too.
Yes.
That the relationship with the congregation to the minister is kind of at the heart of what that is.
Right. So there's no lone wolf ministry anymore. You know, that we don't create ministry authority in a bubble of our own. It is the communal experience with those people we are called to bring ministry to that if we're not answering that call, then it's not effective ministry.
Yeah, which I think is really important when we understand ministry and Community of Christ as servant ministry, that it's not something to boast about ourselves or it's not something to put our ministry, ourselves, our authority on a pedestal, that it really is about you are showing up for the people.
Yes.
And having that kind of at the center allows that to flourish more.
Right, and the sacrament becomes the vital thing, not the priesthood authority. that the experience of the sacrament becomes the ministry, and we as priesthood are the bringer, you know, the tools by which that happens.
So let's just go through the eight sacraments of the church.
Okay. I'm
really interested in knowing what is tradition and then what is a requirement.
So, and I really want you to chime in regard to, I know some of the differences in practices with the LDS church and how they, and yet it's really interesting for a member of Community of Christ to experience any of the sacraments in the LDS church, because there are so many similarities, it's shocking, and so many differences, it's shocking.
Yeah.
And so, well, let's start with baptism, since I began to go in that direction. So a lot of it goes back to, well, what are we doing in baptism? And I think the movement of the trajectory of where we are as a faith movement today went from a salvation-oriented sacrament to a personal acceptance of discipleship experience. So we've kind of moved from the idea that in these acts are representations of the salvation that we experience through Christ, but they're not the one and only point. And so baptism becomes a public expression of a person's willingness to follow Jesus Christ. And that's experienced in the life and death of Jesus Christ, which is experienced in, you know, the going into the water and the coming out. Now, the difficulty comes, if you're talking about practices, the difficulty comes when a 4'5" woman is baptizing a, you know, 6'10" person who weighs 300 pounds. that mechanic of lowering someone backwards into the water and pulling them up becomes problematic in those experiences. So we've tried to create ways and practices where a priesthood member can, you know, dip someone down and back up, and a lot of tips to them, to folks who are doing it in lakes and rivers, of what to be careful of and how to baptize going upstream and those kind of things, all to be done to ensure that there's not embarrassment on the part of the candidate and the minister. We want to focus the experience on, you know, the personal discipleship and the importance of the community being present who have witnessed this person saying, I want to be a follower of Jesus, is just as important as the person going into the waters of baptism. And so other things like it's not a prayer, it's more of a baptismal statement that we make. It's the same in both the Community of Christ and the LDS, I believe. And where you call them by name, having been commissioned of Jesus Christ, I baptize you in the name of the Father, Son, Holy Ghost, or Spirit. And you baptize them. By the way, that prayer also is been looked at by conferences in the past as to, you know, does it follow our wording in Community of Christ the best way possible for today in English. And so that prayer is still being scrutinized. And so the idea of baptizing by the age of 8 is still a strong procedural date for us, just because the idea of it being a personal decision. And when is that personal decision? Well, around 8 is still a good shot of trying to determine when a child can make that determination. And also in the recent history of Community of Christ, we have accepted other denominations' water baptism after the age of 8 as valid in Community of Christ too. So you can see that it's taken away from the one church ideal and been more of a question about personal connection as a disciple of Jesus Christ.
And I would say that in the LDS tradition, there definitely still is the idea that you have to be baptized by the right authority, and they would consider that a saving ordinance. They don't necessarily use the word sacrament. Sacrament would be communion for them, but they very much hold to the idea that you cannot have salvation without baptism, which ties into the whole idea of baptisms for the dead. And, you know, they don't accept any other baptisms. You have to be baptized by their authority. And they also are very particular about body parts coming up out of the font. I remember there was a whole slew of kids that was baptized the same day I was into the Mormon church. And one of my good friends had to be baptized 3 times because her foot or knee kept popping up, and it was.
And there's still pockets within our church who would still do that because the change comes slowly. But you know, we ask a question of new priesthood. You know, so does God invalidate the sacrament because a minor procedural part has not been observed? And then you have to say then it is the ritual that brings salvation. And if that's the case, then how do we know that one of my hairs didn't stay up on top when I got baptized? You know, is God really interested in that? Or is God interested in the act of someone saying publicly, yes, I am going to be a follower of Jesus Christ? And we follow in the tradition of the early Christians who knew that when they were being baptized, they'd probably be killed because of it. Mm. And that kind of a belief system is so strong that our forebearers were willing to risk ridicule because they felt so strongly about their faith. And so it unites us with that greater Christian community. It unites us with those people who have made that decision in the past. And it says, yes, I'm following in this ancient tradition that Jesus himself actually did to say that I connect myself with that ancient practice.
Exactly. Which I think, I just think there's so much beauty in that, connecting disciples of Jesus over the course of centuries. So what are some of the other traditions that you see? I know that we have talked about one, particularly maybe what you wear or the color that you're supposed to wear when you're baptized.
In baptism. Yeah. Yeah. So everybody used to wear white, you know, and we asked that question, and it was in our priesthood manuals, you know, wear white. And then you think to yourself, okay, first of all, why are we wearing white? Well, because it's a holy color. Okay. I don't know. And then what is the worst color to wear when you get wet? You know, what are we doing? And if there's symbolism in color, you know, why do we put these stipulations on people when they come to be baptized? And especially in impoverished nations where the color white would be impractical, why would we demand that they wear white? And so the letting go of these, you know, certain ideals, especially as we go into a more postmodern culture, is to recognize, well, what's the most important part of this ritual that we do? And that is the experience of the person who is being baptized and the community that has surrounded them to accept them as a disciple, to somehow in that experience connect them with the holy and to experience that moment in time that they hopefully will reflect on the rest of their life, that they maybe have prepared for all their life. My granddaughter Lola was baptized within the year. And at the age of 7, she kept asking me, because we still have the tradition of those under 7 as church member families don't partake in the Lord's Supper until after they've made that commitment of discipleship. And she you know, the trays were passing by her again, and she looks at me and she goes, "Papa, why can't I take the bread and the grape juice?" And I said, "Well," and I explained the whole idea of age 8. And she said, "Well, what's so important about age 8? And I said, "Well, that's around the time where you can make a decision to follow Jesus." And she sat back and rolled her eyes up in her head. And she said, "Oh, Papa, I made that decision a long time ago." And I said to Lola, I can't argue. You know that. She was so excited to be baptized at age 8. She could not wait. The Sunday after her birthday, she was there at the baptismal font. And by the way, every time there's Lord's Supper, she's make sure she tries to get to that because it's important to her at that young of an age. And I wish that everyone who experiences baptism could experience that anticipation and that that exhilaration of declaring their discipleship and understanding what that means in their life, even at that early part in time.
Yeah, I know. I have twin daughters who are 8, and a couple months ago, I was serving communion, and one of them, I think, was in the bathroom or something. She wasn't messing around. She was doing something legitimate, but she missed half of communion. And I can't remember if she missed the first part or the second part, either the bread or the juice. But she was so upset that I did not track her down. And I was not doing it to exclude her. I just had a congregation, you know, half of a congregation to serve, and she was missed. And it was kind of stopped me a little bit because of how important it was to her. And she was really upset about it. So she ended up, I ended up giving it to her, you know, a little bit later. I'm pretty sure she missed the first part. So she was really concerned that she couldn't take the juice because she hadn't taken the bread first. And, you know, I had to reassure her that it was okay and that she would get the bread and, you know, but just seeing that angst, and she's like, I've been waiting all month for this.
And there are adults who are doing the same thing. You know, and we don't recognize it as leaders. And it's an important thing for us as priesthood members to recognize. There are people who have come every Sunday, you know, to the Lord's Supper, anticipating and wanting it to be meaningful. And it's really easy for us priesthood to take it nonchalantly. Mm-hmm. And yet there are deep needs that we don't know of when we're handing out the bread and the grape juice. So yeah, so you know, as far as the ritual goes, how can we make it meaningful and get rid of some of the things that can make it embarrassing? So the color of clothes. Another thing we've really, you know, talked to priesthood members are, you know, dressing areas after the baptism. Especially with our two deep leadership that's required for priesthood member and creating safe spaces for children. You know, these are things we want to bring up when we're training priesthood so that every part of the ritual can be remembered as being a positive experience.
Yeah, exactly. So as I'm realizing, so many of these sacraments overlap. They're related to each other. So we've kind of spilled in to talk about communion, the Lord's Supper. But before we really dive into that one, I guess the next logical one, which I totally left off the outline, I'm telling you,
it's not unusual. It's not, so confirmation, huh?
Confirmation, yes.
So confirmation is the most misunderstood sacrament in the Restoration, well, in Christianity. And it comes down to the question of what are we confirming? And I really ask all new priesthood members, what do you really think you're doing in the confirmation prayer? And if we go to our past and put on, you know, granddad's jacket, we used to think that confirmation, by the act of confirmation, we were actually conferring the Holy Spirit upon a person. And by doing so, we've done a grave misjustice, because we really believe that God's Spirit has not attempted to be a part of someone from the beginning, and that by our authority of priesthood, that they only receive it after we lay hands on them. We know better. That's not the case. That confirmation is a lifelong experience, for one, if we're talking about the confirmation of the Holy Spirit. So we went back to Jesus's experience after his baptism. And his confirmation experience consists of the Spirit falling on him in the form of a dove, whatever that means, and a voice coming saying, "This is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased, hear him." Well, who is hearing the voice? Who is seeing the dove? And we recognize, well, it was Jesus, but it was also those who were gathered around the river. It was also those who were there present, who heard and saw and experienced. So confirmation becomes not only the individual experience, it becomes the corporate experience. And in most cases, the sacraments of the church are lessons in us getting it. That there are experiences and rituals where we should take the palm of our hand and slap it onto our forehead and go, "Oh my gosh, yeah, Confirmation is the priesthood member praying, the individual receiving, and the congregation going, oh my gosh, God's in them too. I confirm that God is in that human being. And maybe I didn't see it until now, or maybe I didn't acknowledge it until now, but there is God. There is the Holy Spirit resident within someone. And so where baptism becomes the personal declaration of discipleship, confirmation becomes the corporate announcement of, yeah, you and us belong together. We're on this journey together. And so the person who is experiencing it should also, the candidate should also be saying, oh my gosh, you know, when I was 6 years old, I had an experience where God was a part of my life, and I didn't even recognize it till now. And the promise in the future that in the times that are difficult or the times where a new idea needs to be placed in, that that Spirit will still be there and still be present and still be moving us in new directions. So confirmation is a wonderful experience when we as a community come together and we say to the candidate as the congregation, not only welcome to the community, but our community has been, our community hasn't been whole until you came. And our community will not be whole without you. So it's the mutual need of each other that we also recognize within the confirmation experience, because God's Spirit is resident within us all, and we need each other to recognize and discover that.
I absolutely love the way that you frame that. And that actually really helped me with my own understanding and theology behind confirmation. I know that in Salt Lake, when we have new members officially join us, you know, sometimes people join by baptism. I chose to be baptized, and some opt for the confirmation only option, which is great. But every time that I've heard a confirmation, I think I've done one confirmation myself, been the minister to voice a confirmation. I've assisted in a few others, but the acknowledgement that this is a continued journey with God, that you aren't necessarily, now you have some greater access to God's Spirit or God's love or worthiness or anything like that, that it's a continued stop on the journey and that we are now joining you. And I really like that you said that we were not whole until you joined us. I think that's really beautiful.
Yeah. So you do have to ask a question. So in Community of Christ, you know, why can we accept others' baptism, but we still require confirmation? And mm-hmm. and I think we have the answer in what we've discussed here is that it is the community coming together and going, okay, I get it now. As much as it is the candidate saying, yes, I belong with these people. And it also goes back, we help the new priests and the new elders who do this to also not emphasize so much membership in quotes, because otherwise that means the Shelby system, which is our membership online system, would be the holy collector of souls, basically. And that's not what we mean. That membership is not as important as the belongingness that we are experiencing in that. Because that, again, the membership goes back to our past of the one true church, that being a member of the church also assured salvation and separated us from the rest. And so in place of that, we recognize a little bit better what confirmation is in the life of the church today. Yes, it does mean the traditional experience of being logged in as a member of Community of Christ, but it's much more meaningful than that. And it's part of that. We also, another part that will also come to all the prayers that are given, impromptu prayers that are done in the sacraments, is we're really trying to help the priesthood to put this in a prayer form rather than a personal statement form. And the difference comes from when you lay the hands on the person's head and say, Jane, I confirm you instead saying, Lord, we come here to celebrate the confirmation of Jane. To turn those, because again, the tape recordings are going on in our head from Uncle Elmer and the way he used to say the prayer. And into what we're really trying to do is to make this statement a connective experience of us to God. Rather than the authority figure of the priesthood making a claim. And so language is important, and how we phrase that, we're trying to help our priesthood understand a little bit better too.
Yeah, I think that that's a really theologically intentional shift. And it's not one that I even had paid much attention to until I was going through the temple school courses to be ordained. But then to realize, yeah, actually who we are addressing in this sacrament, really important. I mean, there's theology. Yeah.
And for us old time folks like me, I mean, I did an ordination last week and I started out perfectly fine. And somewhere in the middle, I said, and Jody, we blah, blah, blah. And the little voice in the back of my head started screaming, and I brought myself back around. And so even those of us who have been trained, it's really hard to get rid of those audio tapes in our head.
Yeah.
And change our procedure so that we're doing what we really mean rather than the way it's always been done. Mm-hmm.
So I guess moving right along, we've already talked about the Lord's Supper a little bit, but I think that there are definitely some traditions in that one that we can lift up. So just start talking about communion.
Yeah. So the Lord's Supper, you know, pretty basic. You've got little pieces of bread. You've got little sips of wine here in the West for the most part. Everybody kneels. We say the blessing over the bread and the grape juice. We're trying to say grape juice more than wine so that we are understood what we are serving in the Western countries. So in Community of Christ, we do it once a month at the first Sunday of every month. And that is done because of Section 119, which was a time of controversy in the reorganization where we were trying to figure out how often does often mean to serve the Lord's Supper. And we also were going through a little bit of a difficulty. We lost members over this, by the way, of going from the common cup to individual cups.
Wow.
Because, yeah, there were people who believed that the common cup was the only way, that when Jesus talked about the cup, it was a cup. And can you imagine, Brittany, in the mid 1800s, late 1800s, with men's beards and long mustaches being on the bottom end of that common cup? There were a lot of good reasons why you didn't want to get the cup late in the service and have to deal with you know, that. But so yeah, it's funny what we get locked into. So, you know, now the Lord's Supper has also been expanded into, well, and it's been done this way for decades now, into other areas of special services. You might see the Lord's Supper done differently at a reunion or a camp or at a special retreat, where at sometimes in different times of the year, people will come up to partake of the emblems rather than to be served. You know, as long as the basic guidelines are followed and the basic requirements are given so that there is some commonality to it being done so that the ritual is not lost, but at the same time that we don't lose the purpose and meaning of the sacrament by not being able to have some freedom with it. So it's one of those kind of balancing areas of appropriateness, and we have jurisdictional officers who can tell us whether or not you know, something has gone too far or not. And most of it for the Lord's Supper is the blessing and who is passing it, which is different, I think, in the LDS Church. So in Community of Christ, only priests and elders actually take the trays to the participants, but I think other priesthood does that in the LDS Church.
Yeah, it's generally deacons that do that, and along with that, they don't the deacon does not serve each individual person. They just pass it to the first person on the row, and then the congregants pass it down. So it's been interesting in some
way. How traditions, when they separate, you know, different traditions, and they lock onto them. I mean, that actually seems a whole lot more liberal as far as priesthood authority goes in the sacrament than Community of Christ does.
And that actually has been kind of one of the arguments to ordain women or to allow women to pass the sacrament in an official capacity, because Mormon women are passing the sacrament of communion all the time because they're just passing it back to whoever is next to them. And it's been interesting in Salt Lake because we have new visitors every single week. And so when we have visitors on communion, we sometimes will do kind of a statement, because it does look mechanically so different. We'll kind of explain how it's going to work. But there are still times where somebody at the end, if they happen to be a visitor, will try to take the tray from you. And I've had the tray taken from me before, and I'm like, oh no, what do I do?
Yeah, so the question is, what does serving in quotes mean?
Yeah. You
know? Yeah. And other little issue differences. We usually always have grape juice that could come from Welch's or could come from somebody's backyard. And I think the LDS usually use water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And that comes probably from the admonishment to only make wine of your own make, which is really hard to come by nowadays. And Community of Christ has gone, it's grape juice. So, you know, it's good. Now I've been a part of youth camps where we've had Cheerios and Gatorade for our emblems, mm-hmm. just because it was present and it worked, and the whole symbolism was still there. In other countries where grape juice is not present, you know, you might see coconut water or other things used, different kinds of bread. Now in the United States and Canada, the use of gluten-free bread served so that people with gluten allergies can partake, and water served for those who, you know, might have diabetic issues or things. So we're trying to make it as accessible as possible to people with various needs.
Yeah, and I think that having that flexibility that's still grounded in tradition and ritual is important. But we don't get locked into it where it's so rigid that we can't have some flexibility.
Right. And then we go back again to, why are we doing this? So what is the purpose? And our purpose really follows the prayer of remembrance, that we are remembering what Christ did. We are remembering our discipleship. We take a break from the regular service to remember. And so there are usually some periods of silence or meditation during our Lord's Supper experience. And usually that's in the mechanics also of how it's being served. And that we are not, again, experiencing a salvation-oriented experience. We are renewing and remembering our discipleship commitment that we've made. And this is part of the reason why, though Community of Christ has gone from being a close communion group to an open communion group, that's the reason why still some members who have children choose to wait until they're of age 8 and have been baptized before they partake. So it is a remembrance experience. But our priesthood are now instructed that they are not they're not the gatekeepers of who gets the sacrament and who doesn't. They are the bridge to the remembrance. So it's not up to them to make that determination. It's up to the individual who chooses to reach for the emblems of whether or not they want to partake. And so we try to make it as open as possible to everyone who is present at that experience to know that they're welcome at the table and that they are invited to experience that remembrance, whatever that is for them.
I'm really glad that you added that last part, because again, in Salt Lake, and I keep bringing it up, obviously, because that's my congregation, but we have people either show up at a regular service, or maybe they're coming for what we call Sunstone Sunday after the large symposium. So this is the first time that they've ever stepped into Community of Christ or to a church for 1, 2, 3, 5, 10 years. Mm-hmm. And or that they have been going to church but have been barred from taking communion because there's a level of worthiness that you must uphold in the LDS church in order to take communion. And so I have served communion to people who have not had the opportunity to take it in years. And so not only is it interesting because I'm a woman offering this, but then I am not making a judgment call whether they are quote unquote worthy or not. That's not even in my vernacular of the sacrament whatsoever.
So worthiness is in Community of Christ a personal choice, and the emphasis placed on the church is to say, you are welcome. And hopefully that if we as a church can make someone who feels they are unworthy to partake in the sacraments for just a moment feel like they are worthy, then we've done our job. And that a communal experience, again, it's not just the personal experience of taking the Lord's Supper, it's the communal experience. That we are all taking it together. We're all experiencing this renewal together. Yeah, we all have come there as broken people. And there is brokenness down the road too. And we're going to need to be reminded again. But the wonderful nature of our God is the call to continue to come to the table, to join together, to find redemption, to find that release in the experience of the sacraments.
Yeah, I absolutely love how Community of Christ views communion and that all are welcome and that it's not a place of division or a mark of who's in or who's out. It's just welcome to the table, which, yeah, has completely changed my whole aspect on grace. And it is really theologically driven and grounded in deep, welcoming, open love.
And in full disclosure, it's been a long road for us in Community of Christ to get there.
Yeah.
So, you know, we were closed communionists, and I recognized for the first time when I went to a National Youth Workers Convention long time ago, back in the 80s, where we were still in closed communionists. And the last service was, you know, for these 3,000 people who were in this arena, was a communion service. And I had always been instructed I was not to partake of somebody else's communion because where was their authority and yada, yada. And I was a rebel and I went ahead and joined in that service with those people. And it was moving and it was meaningful as any that I had experienced in my denomination. And that was the beginning of my breakdown as a young adult of understanding that my God and was much bigger than what I had made God to be. And now that has kind of permeated most of Community of Christ to the recognition of God's ability. Every time we in the church try to put God in the box, God's ability to break free of that box and to move us into places where we used to believe God was not present.
Mm. Grateful you all did the hard work.
We're still doing it, girl. You know it.
Yeah.
You know, and we got a lot of work left to do.
For sure. For sure. For sure. All right. So.
Well, let's see. Where are we? We did Lord's Supper pretty much, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, we could spend a whole, you know, podcast on each one of these. Well, let's talk of laying on of hands. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So back to the procedure and everything. So we're doing the procedure stuff for baptism, and in most of our priesthood manuals, it says that priesthood, when they're about to give the baptismal statement, raise their right hand and say, "Having been commissioned of Jesus Christ," blah blah blah. And so our standard was to have Doctrine and Covenants or World Church Action to determine what are required elements. Well, there's nothing in the Doctrine and Covenants about the hand raised during the baptismal prayer, and there was nothing in conference action about it. So I had to find out where that came from, and it was, you know, it was in most of our priesthood manuals. And so, you know, the church historian at that time and I had a number of discussions about it, and we began to become aware as us Community of Christ people who have been long believers that Masonic influence has never been a part of our faith movement, began to recognize that this was the arm to the square made for making a proclamation or a sacred promise. And then we also recognize that in the early church, that whenever someone prophesied, they'd also put their hand to the square. So now we're at the dilemma of, well, if we're trying to put why we do things with every part of the ritual, then what do we say about this? You know, do we put this as a required element or a traditional element? And we finally, after a long discussion with the First Presidency, decided to put it as a traditional element. In other words, we do it as a tradition. If you choose not to do it, it's not going to invalidate the experience. But, you know, you should be careful about people who might have questions about it in the congregation and see if it's an issue. So then I went to Tahiti, and we were filming. We've got a number of videos, by the way, on the Community of Christ webpage in the priesthood section. We've got videos on each one of the eight sacraments that are done as an introduction to new priesthood on how we're going to perform the sacraments, and anyone can look at those videos. So I was in Tahiti shooting some of the video for that, and I asked them about the laying on of hands for the sick, and we went to a person's house where they performed the sacrament there, and then I was asking them about one of the questions that we had in regard to why we do certain practices, and it's called the consecration of oil. So we use olive oil whenever we lay hands on for the sick, and just a drop on the forehead, and it says that we're supposed to consecrate the oil or use consecrated oil. But what does that mean? And how are we to inform priesthood, you know, how to do that? So I said, okay, I'm in Tahiti. Let's ask, you know, a different culture. How do you do that? And they said, well, our evangelist for the islands does that, does the consecration. I said, really? And I said, is there any chance I could watch him do that? And said, sure. And so we set up the cameras and everything. And he goes and takes the cap off the oil and then raises his arm to the square and gives a blessing over it. And I looked and I thought, oh my gosh, I'm not going to be able to use that. Because in the United States, in Western culture, we don't raise the right hand up when we're consecrating oil. And so I asked him afterwards, so why do you raise your hand when you're giving the blessing? He said, oh, you know, back in the early days when the missionaries came here, they taught us to do that. And I thought, oh my gosh, here's something that we Westerners taught them to do. That practice has been lost in the United States. We don't do that anymore, but they continue to carry it on as tradition. So the place of tradition on all of these rituals is really complex. And how do you say what is tradition of what's required and what's important in each one of these rituals? So that's a little caveat on how problematic sometimes this can be when trying to inform people how to do these sacraments. So laying on the hands for the sick. For us, it's basically someone calls for the elders to come and give a prayer for them. We do one really short prayer, which is an anointing prayer that helps focus us on what the ritual is about and for. And then the longer prayer of administration, and we're trying to get away from the word administration because what does that mean today? But the prayer of blessing, where the person prays for God's will to be done in the life of that individual and of God's presence with them during the difficult time. We do not pray for healing per se, because sometimes our idea of healing and God's idea of healing are two different things. And sometimes also God's ultimate healing is the relief of death. And our understanding of that and our desires for blessing may be different than what God's desire for blessing is. So we hold that person up as a loved child of God and pray for them to recognize the presence of God with them at the difficult part of their journey. And so I'm not really sure in the LDS church how that ritual is experienced.
So I would say it's really similar, but there's, because of automatic ordination, it's essentially any adult male can give quote unquote blessings is what they would call it. And so in the land of Latter-day Seeker ministry, there's been maybe this assumption from a lot of Latter-day Seekers that just any adults in the church can give it because they just assume that every adult is ordained to the office.
So this is what they're talking about, blessing, giving a yes. family blessing or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So because of that, because of the idea that most, if not all men are ordained, it really becomes a father. So that you hear often a father's blessing. So that's kind of culturally become a thing, I guess. So it can be difficult when seekers come and they, you know, basically have to quote, give up their priesthood or what have you, because they have this, idea that is very tied into family relationships, being the head of the household, things like that. So, or even it, with home teaching, and I actually, I've been out so long that I don't even think home teaching is a thing anymore. So I'm feeling kind of geriatric in my ex-Mormonism. Yeah. But you have kind of congregational leadership that is over certain families or individuals or whatever. But it is very tied to kind of your stewardship of your flock. And of course that would be just male oriented.
And is olive oil used?
Yes. Consecrated olive oil. And I'm not sure what that process looks like. I actually don't think there's always a prayer of anointing that goes along with it either. I think they might just jump straight into the blessing.
Well, and this has also been a problem in our faith movement. So you have two prayers, okay? And in the old days, they used to be about, you know, they used to be kind of competitive. You know, who are the two people who are going to give the better prayer, you know? And so they could go on for long periods of time while the person's dying in their bed, you know? And that does not get the message of the sacrament across so well. So we're really trying to help priesthood recognize, you know, keep this does not need to be a lengthy ortation. Yeah, this is you caring about somebody, and you've been called because they're crying out for help. Mm-hmm. It could be physical, it could be emotional, it could be, you know, relationship oriented, and in most cases, it's outside of your family. It's people who have called you in. I had a woman who called me in when I was a pastor. Called me into her congregation who could not speak. And in the course of my discussion with her about the prayer, she asked me to pray that she'd pass away.
Wow.
And I was not prepared for that because nobody teaches you yet. And that's a good thing to do. And I kind of walked my way around it, but I prayed for God's will to be done. And sure enough, within hours, she passed away. And I realized that she just needed permission. And sometimes we as ministers are called in these times of life difficulties to tell them it's going to be okay. You're held in loving hands, and whatever happens at this point in time, know that those hands are still going to hold you tightly. Yeah, so it's probably one of the most difficult sacraments, and it calls upon every part of our ability to look at how we as priesthood members can help someone. And sometimes there's nothing we can do. Most times there's nothing we can do except to be the example of Jesus in that time of need.
Yeah, because people aren't necessarily calling you for help when things are going great, when you get called on for a blessing, laying on of hands administration, then there's definitely some amount of crisis or vulnerability that's going to be associated with it.
Absolutely. And as in all the other sacraments, this is the one that's done privately in most cases, but we as the priesthood bring the community with us. Because the person also needs to know that it's not just me and my ministry companion who have come to lay hands on you. You've got the support of everyone back in your home congregation. They all love you. They care about you. They're concerned for you. And they might not know of your need, but we carry their concerns with us.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about ordination.
Ordination. Yeah. So, so ordination is not so much the passing of the mantle anymore. Again, it's one of those road signs that have taken us from our discipleship that we have publicly proclaimed and into the act of being examples of ministry. And so in Community of Christ, we have a number of priesthood offices. So you're not going to necessarily be called first to the office of deacon. You're going to be called in regard to where you are presently and what your gifts are, as interpreted by your pastor, and placed into the office that matches those gifts at that particular time. Priesthood is not a time and eternity experience in Community of Christ. It is a here and now experience, and a one that's in flux. It's probable that you won't hold one priesthood office for all your life. And it is possible actually to go from what was considered a higher office to a lower office in your lifetime if you choose, that if it was part of your earlier calling. We have begun the process of looking at different ways of expressing priesthood calls and times where one might need a sabbatical, a time away, a leave. And also, what happens to a person when they have been a priesthood member and then they stop acting in priesthood responsibilities for a long period of time. And also in Community of Christ, we have a way of still retaining your priesthood office, but taking on the emeritus title. So we can have an elder emeritus. They can still perform sacraments if requested and approved by their pastor, but they don't need to be fully functioning in their office. And this is helpful to those people who are a little bit higher in age and need to let go of some of those duties because of their abilities. So priesthood is a personal calling. Each one of our priesthood offices has a list of expressions of what that office is, and those are also able to be found on the church's website in the priesthood page. And there's preparation that's required before you take an office. You're required in your first priesthood call to take an introduction to ministry class, an introduction to scripture class where you're taught the exegesis process, and then also to take a class on the specific office that you have been called to. And once you have taken those classes and once the congregational approval and World Church approval has been given to the call, then you're ordained.
And I do just want to say that we recently did, I guess maybe it wasn't recently, I don't know, depending on how you measure time. We did a podcast episode with Janae Grover mm-hmm. that kind of walks through the
process. Yeah, I heard that one. That was good.
Yeah, she goes into really good depth about each priesthood office and the process of being called to each priesthood office.
Yeah. So we have moved in Community of Christ from being holders of priesthood. the idea that you hold priesthood. Try and unravel that. Yeah. What does that mean to hold priesthood rather than being called to priesthood? And that calling is a continual process. It's the continual answering of the call of the need of the congregation, of the community, of the church, and also the importance of self-care, that building spiritual practices in your own life make you a better minister. Reminding yourself how Jesus was a minister makes you a better minister. So the educational part, the experience part, are all part of the continual calling that we go through. We encourage priesthood members every year to make an annual plan where they decide this year, this is what I'm going to focus on. This is what I really feel God is calling me to move in. And you talk to your pastor about that and talk about how that might be accomplished. It's really great for pastors because when priests do that, then all of a sudden the pastor starts saying, my gosh, I've got three or four people who are feeling a call in this direction that we haven't even planned for. Maybe God's moving us in that direction. And what can we do to move in that direction? So that symbiotic relationship with the congregation is also really important because the congregation and the church have asked you to be representative. And God has asked you to be representative. So again, this interplay between God's experience and the calling, your acceptance of the calling, the congregational's acceptance of the calling, the world church's acceptance of the calling, come as you begin to represent all of these, yourself included, as a priesthood member.
Exactly. And I think that that's, I mean, it puts together all the puzzle pieces of congregational or mission center or, you know, whatever level of jurisdiction you're working at, but all those pieces just start to come together when each office is fully living itself right out.
So, you know, from a Community of Christ's past experience, the stratification of the priesthood offices, I mean, even going as far as calling the Aaronic priesthood the lesser priesthood, we really have tried to move from that and recognized the importance of each one of these offices in their calling. When deacons are called to ensure that the facilities are sacramentally in place, you know, that they are participating in the sacraments of the church too, even though they might not be the ministers of the sacrament. And this also, for the first time, 3 years ago when we came up with the chart, gosh, I can't even remember how long ago it was. We added also into the list of priesthood offices, we listed disciples. And that was done purposefully because we're beginning to also recognize the priesthood of member, the importance of our initial call, our call that follows every other call we'll have into priesthood is the call of being a disciple of Jesus Christ. And each of those has a certain duty. And so for me as being a high priest, I really struggled when I was called to the office of high priest because I felt like it made sense administratively because I was about to become a mission center president, but I didn't think that was a good enough reason to be a high priest. And then when I looked over that a high priest is also a bridge between different cultures and groups within our church, and that a high priest is also called to bring the vision and mission of the church to the congregations, then all of a sudden I started to connect the dots and say, okay, I'm already doing that. I'm very involved in cultural generational ministry, and I'm already a part of that. So I saw that the calling had already been realized in my life, and that my accepting of the ordination was further confirming what God was already doing in my personal life.
I guess I'll reluctantly say I've had the same experience.
Well, you know, there is an interesting interplay of priesthood. There is the time where you don't hold it and you realize to yourself, I could be doing so much more. And they're preventing me from doing that, you know, because I'm not called and I'm not ordained. And then there's also the fear and trepidation of you've been called now. Now what are you going to do?
Yeah.
And I say that anybody who doesn't go into priesthood without fear and trembling is not considered what you're lining up to do. It's an awesome and terrifying responsibility sometimes. And I think that's the recognition of that, as well as the acceptance of the furthering of our own personal discipleship, but also that there are people out there who need it. That's sometimes what I talk to new candidates about. As they're struggling of whether or not I should answer this call, I ask them, well, do the people need you in that position? And most of them will say, yeah, they probably do. And then they say, that's the pinch point. God's calling you where the people need you. Will you answer that? And yeah, good discussions to have.
Oh, yeah, that's kind of the point that I was at with both of my ordinations, both to the office of priest and to the office of elder. Both were a reluctant, or not, I'm not reluctant, but both were an, oh my gosh, can I do this? Yes, because I recognized the need in Salt Lake. And so for me saying yes, it felt like I was saying that I could somehow fill this need or fix this need or whatever. And I just did not have, and I still don't have, what I perceive as the level of confidence that ministers should have all the time.
Right. You know? And that's somewhat cultural too. You know, so you're experiencing what my wife Bethany experienced in the 80s. And and that was, I never grew up thinking I'd be a priesthood member.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I grew up as a kid always thinking, well, that's a goal to which I hope to aspire someday. Mm-hmm. And so when I was in church, I watched and I learned and I thought, well, I see men doing that. I will probably do that someday too. Bethany, on the other hand, was like, I'm experiencing it because that's all I'm going to have in my lifetime. So when the opportunity to serve came to her, it was quite shocking and quite different because we're changing our paradigms. And so I can relate to, women coming into the community of Christ. You're still amongst people, maybe older, who went through that. My daughter grew up seeing her mother performing sacraments and doing work in the church and doesn't know any different. And so, you know, for her, it's a different experience. So the I guess getting to the point, and there are some people who come into the church who never planned to be a minister. And I would imagine the same is true for them also. To be called is an awesome experience. And I mean that in both the fearful awesome as well as the exciting awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a journey. And I think that's one reason why I don't know how to say this, get along so well with people your generation in the church, especially the women. Most of my quote unquote friends or peers feel like they're over 50 because I just relate to the experience of
it's generation. It's freaky what you're born into, you know, and how that sticks with you for your life. Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
It is
baby blessings.
Yes.
So we lay hands on children under the age of 8 and pray a prayer of blessing. It's basically what Jesus did with children in his day. I don't think we've ever attributed any salvation orientation to baby blessing, although there's still this phrase that comes up. Once in a great while, may God write your name in the Lamb's Book of Life. And every time it's not said that often anymore, but every time that's said, it's like fingernails on a blackboard. You mean God has a book? Really? God has a book that's keeping, and what does that mean? What does it mean if you're in the book or not in the book and that kind of stuff? So that kind of theology hopefully has washed through us at this time. And it's basically the community coming around a child and saying, hooray, life, child, valuable, God loves. And we are part of the community that will help raise this child with their parents. And we support them in that. And we feel blessed as a community to have this child a part of us and she a part of we. So, and again, I'm not familiar how the LDS Church does that. Is it any different?
Slightly, but significantly. So again, it's all very much family oriented. So
is it done in the ward?
It is. So it's done in public. That's one of the only ones. Well, not one of the only ones, but something like ordination is usually done in private.
In private. Is that right? Even to elder and high priest and 70 and.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually don't think I've ever seen an ordination in the LDS Church, which is bizarre because I have two brothers, but I don't have any recollection of that.
Is it done in a back room or do family come or?
I would say probably in the bishop's office, and I think immediate family come.
Wow.
But I don't know. Somebody might correct me with this, but it definitely is not done in a worship service.
How about that?
But baby blessings are. And it's almost 100% either the father or the grandfather, unless it's a first generation new convert family. But if it can be a relative, then it always is. And then they also often will have all the male relatives, so the uncles, the grandparents, male cousins, any male in the family will circle the child. So you'll see it's not just the parents. The mom actually is not allowed to hold or even hold the microphone or anything like that. So it's all very patrilineal, yeah, about priesthood authority within the family. So,
right. Yeah, we're even trying to talk to new priesthood and talk about the ability to allow the mother or the father to hold the child while you're blessing them. Mm-hmm. Because what baby wants to be against a stranger's full suit, you know? And that's, yeah. Again, the idea is to provide some kind of a ministerial sacramental experience rather than causing the baby to cry and then trying to talk over the baby during the blessing, and to keep it short. And and again, the involvement of the community of the congregation around the sacrament is vital to the sacrament. Yeah. And I have to say, as a grandparent, married to another priesthood member, there is a little competition between the grandparents of who gets to give the baby blessing, just a little. And though we would not in any way publicly display that, in our private moments, there have been tabs kept in my family, and I'm behind. So,
well, knowing you and Bethany and how non-competitive, and sense my sarcasm in there.
That's a whole nother podcast.
You are. It shocks me 0%.
Let's see. So that leaves marriage and evangelist blessing.
Yeah.
Marriage. Oh, there's no difference between us and the LDS Church, I'm sure.
None at all. Let me tell you.
Man, I've been watching the news here lately. Yeah, so I was a college student, a new priest, and I did my first marriage, my first wedding to some other, to a couple who was at our college. And we got through the wonderful service that had just been completed, and they were walking down the aisle, and this cold sweat went down my back, and I realized I'd skipped over in the service the required vows that Community of Christ uses from, you know, Joseph Smith's time. And I ran to the reception line, and I looked at him, and I said, "Do you both mutually agree to be each other's commanded husband and wife, blah, 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 blah?" And they said, "Yes." And I said, "Now you're married." Now, we still have the required elements of the statement, but boy, I tell you what, marriage ceremonies can go all over the board. I've done them outside. I've done them in people's homes, you know, and as we're now moving into areas of expansion of what marriage means, to be able to stay faithful to the words of our ritual, but still be engaged in same-sex marriages, and if we're places where it's not allowed to find ways where commitment services can take place, and then to look at the whole concept of marriage as a whole, because outside of all the other sacraments, marriage in culture in the West is changing rapidly. And what does it mean? What is the purpose for the church to be engaged in this civil determination? And what is the purpose for us celebrating when people have agreed to join as family? And the various forms that family is taking in this time and place, and where it's the trajectory is going. So we'll be looking at marriage over and over again at World Conference over the next number of years. It is a moving target. and how we continue to keep the element of community and family and committed relationships a part of the sacraments of the church will continue to change, I'm sure.
Yeah, I really appreciate that because it brings in this idea of not only continuing our relation, but common consent and making sure that we keep our core values of just, you know, what are our priorities, I guess, as far as relationship and ministry and things like that goes. So yeah, I am here for these conversations.
Yeah, good. I think that, and it's going to be important. So in my lifetime, I met my wife in high school, and we, you know, dated through high school and into college, got married midway through college. We've been in a committed relationship the rest of our lives, plan to do so into the future. And yet that's not the gold standard anymore. And so how do you affirm those whose relationships still go into a committed place and are planned to go that direction, might not or might? What do we do with young adults when they're recognizing that they're penalized in certain countries for getting married financially in their taxes, mm-hmm. Or benefits or things along that line, but they're in a committed relationship? You know, what is marriage? What is the foundation of marriage? And we're still considering how that works in both Western and non-Western cultures as we move forward.
Yeah, it'll be interesting for sure.
Yeah.
So I think Evangelist Blessing is the only one
evangelist
we have left.
Evangelist Blessing. And the best person to talk about an Evangelist Blessing is an evangelist. Now, we in Kingdom of Christ have a number of evangelists who are usually very well respected people in mission centers or congregations. And their job, their main job as priesthood is to be disconnected from the administration of the church, such as the leadership of being a pastor or a mission center president or something along that line, and to be the purveyor of blessing within the life of the church. And they do that through a personal blessing that can take place in a life of a person seeking direction, or in a congregation, as a congregation seeks a blessing to their purpose and their future. A household blessing. There are many different kinds of blessings that evangelists provide in the life of the church. It's a formally considered a sacrament in the church. Out of the respect of these wise people in our midst, as well as the reception that the community has to receive blessing and direction from those people who are in these respected positions. So that has changed over time. There was a time where evangelists only gave one blessing to an individual for their lifetime, and that was all they were engaged in. The person who gave me my blessing when I was a senior in high school was named Roy Chaville, and he was a former presiding evangelist of our church. The blessing number that he gave me was 1,100 and something. That's how many blessings he had given, individual blessings he had given in his lifetime at that point. And I thought to myself, it was such a personal experience for me. How was it personal when he'd given so many? A really touching experience from the hands of a person who knew what he was doing in giving a late teenager some direction and purpose. And I still read it from time to time. And in congregations now that it's expanded to more areas of formalized blessing, I've seen congregations who have received a blessing for the congregation and used it as kind of a direction for future ministry and possibilities of expansion and mission as they move forward. And again, the way blessings have been given, they used to be like little prophecies to people, And they've moved now to wise people giving wise counsel, and which is a lot more helpful nowadays, because if you were prophesied that you were, you know, going to be a priesthood member across the seas and you never had that happen, well, was God wrong, or did you mess up, or what happened? To get out of the job of creating prophecy and creating help in the journey and directions from people who had been on that journey for quite a while, it turns into a really more helpful tool in the life of the church.
For sure. I have a lot of thoughts on this. Maybe I think we do need to do, I think, a full episode on maybe every single individual sacrament, but especially this one, because in the LDS church, you've asked for some compare and contrasting, and this one is still very much kind of how you would have seen it in the church in Community of Christ, RLDS, you know, several decades ago, where it was just one guy that would give them and you could have one in your lifetime. And it was seen as kind of a spiritual blueprint, and even a practical blueprint.
Did they used to tell you what tribe you belong to?
Yes. Yeah. So
some of that passed through. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep, I'm the tribe of Ephraim.
Well, see, and it always messed me up why my mom and dad were from different tribes and I would have been from another one, you know, how that worked. But, it definitely is not Ancestry.com, but,
Yeah, I think for the most part in the LDS church, the vast majority of people that I know, because I grew up in very much white suburban Utah, are all Ephraim. For some reason, that kind of seems to be the status quo. And then if you have any Latin, Spanish, Latino blood in you, you might get a Manasseh for whatever reason. I'm not actually sure on why that stereotype happens. And I'm kind of afraid to find out.
If you got the tribe of Dan, would that be bad?
Sorry, what was that?
If you got the tribe of Dan, would that be bad?
I mean,
okay, I'm sorry.
I missed a joke. I could tell. I did. I don't even know the top 12 tribes.
It's all right.
There is one of Daniel, right?
Well, there's the Danites. boom, baby.
Okay, I got it. Okay. I thought you were saying like Daniel. I was like, I don't know. I know that they have said, or at least I've heard, that the LDS churches quote unquote track down at least one person from every tribe. So then I was always like, well, then doesn't that mean that the 12 tribes are gathered? Like, where's Jesus? Why isn't this coming?
Lost tribes. We still have lost some of them.
Apparently, I don't know. Yeah. This all goes over my head.
Yeah, well. And for us, it's water under the bridge, so.
Yeah. funny.
Yeah. So that's the sacraments of the church. And language has a lot to do with it. We're still trying to get over, you know, terminology, even for the names of the sacraments in some cases, you know, it's really hard to say the laying on of hands. It's much easier to say administration. But if you're from out of the church, what does administration mean? You know, and from the LDS seeker point of view, it could mean a really negative thing.
Yeah. You know? And sounds like you're in trouble.
Well, and even going from communion to Lord's Supper, we used to in my long ago history, we used to call it Sacrament Sunday, and yet. We're talking about all the sacraments, so let's be, you know, specific in what we're talking about. It's the Lord's Supper. It's Jesus's, you know, Last Supper is our basis, and communion is what we're experiencing in all of the sacraments. So we're trying to, you know, move into the direction of even terminology to be helpful in the sacraments, as well as how we process through the acts of them so that the acts don't get in the way of the spirit of what we're experiencing during them. And that's the goal of what we're doing as we're training the elders and priests in doing the sacraments, as the people behind the scenes in the revelation of Jesus Christ in other people's lives and the community.
Awesome. I usually ask if you have any other thoughts to wrap us up, and maybe if you do, but that was like a mic drop moment. So
yeah, let's leave the mic on the floor on that one.
Oh, well, thank you so much, David. Having a resource where Latter-day Seekers or anyone who's interested in sacraments and Communion of Christ, I mean, this isn't specific for Latter-day Seekers, but particularly that group of people, this will be helpful, a helpful conversation to introduce some of the sacraments of the church. And
sure, and I'd encourage everyone who's interested to go on the Community of Christ website and just type in sacraments in the search. There's a page there on the sacraments, gives some good brief descriptions, and there are videos also that help in better demonstrating how those sacraments are experienced.
Yeah, which I think those videos have been very helpful. I know that I've watched them beyond being required to watch them for ordination. I've watched them post-temple school class just to make sure I'm doing things right. Quote unquote, right.
Right.
The place that we understand the sacraments today, just to make sure that I don't lose the importance or lose my mind or lose.
Good luck with that.
Seriously. Well, thank you so much.
Sure. Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use. And while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.